Welcome everyone to the second of the Gilda Lehmann Lecture Series lectures at the LSE this spring. The topic for tonight, the American Civil War, is of course one of the foremost conflicts of the 19th century, and it left a number of legacies, of which the most important one undoubtedly was a unified country. But there were also more troubling legacies of the war and the Reconstruction that followed. One of them was the enduring disenfranchisement of African Americans. I'm sure we're going to hear more about tonight. And another, some scholars have argued, was a propensity to solve conflicts by the use of force. And all these legacies have a profound influence on the United States we see today. Now, with us to discuss these issues tonight, we have Professor David Blight, who is one of America's foremost authorities on the U.S. Civil War and its legacy. David is the Class of 1954 Professor of American History and Director of the Gilda Lehmann Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale University. And I want to pause to thank the Gilda Lehmann Institute once again for funding, organizing, and facilitating in other ways this lecture series. It is really a breakthrough for those of us here who have a particular interest in American history. Now, I know Professor Blight's work well. I never met him until tonight. His brother Jim, though, is a great friend of mine of many years standing, and I was very tempted to do some of the stories that Jim had been telling me about David in terms of introduction tonight. I won't do that. I'll tell some of them afterwards if the Q&A goes on for too long. I'd rather do a more conventional introduction, mentioning the many works that Professor Blight has undertaken on American history. His most famous book by far is called Race and Reunion, The Civil War in American Memory, published in 2001, which earned a number of awards, including the Frederick Douglass Prize, the Lincoln Prize, if I'm not mistaken, 3 awards from the Organization of American Historians, no less, and the Bancroft Prize, the most prestigious prize given to an American historian. It's a fascinating book, which really presented, in my view, a new way of understanding America's collective response to the war. And it argues that, in the interest of reunification, the country ignored the racist underpinnings of the war, leaving a legacy of racial conflict that lasted well into the 20th century and became part of the fundament of the United States as we know it today. But that's just one of Professor Blight's many books. He's also written on Frederick Douglass's Civil War in a book called Keeping Faith in Jubilee, which came in 1989, and a book on Beyond the Battlefield, Race, Memory, and the American Civil War from 2002. He's also edited and co-edited a number of other books, I think about 5 in all, including a book on politics and race in the Civil War era called Union and Emancipation. To many American history students, he is probably better known than for any of his own immediate research work as the co-author of the most popular U.S. history textbook used in American colleges called A People and a Nation. David Blight taught at Amherst College for 13 years before coming to Yale a couple of years ago. And before his university career, and this his brother insisted that I should mention, he taught for 7 years in a public high school in his hometown of Flint, Michigan. So what we will be presented with tonight is not just a passion for the research and the understanding of American history, it's also a passion for teaching it. David, please.
Thank you, Arnie. And thank you, Svetozar, and others at the LSE who have hosted me these 2 days. It's a great honor to be part of this series. I represent part of the Gilda Lehrmann operation about American history in the United States by directing a center at Yale for the study of slavery and abolition. And it is always good to carry the flag of the Gilda Lehrmann Institute as well. I'm also especially pleased to see at least one of my former students from Yale here. Makes me feel less guilty about missing all my classes today in New Haven. And two dear friends from the past and present, Tony Phillips and Kirsty, who work for BBC Radio, with whom I've done a few programs in recent years. I'm going to speak, as Arnie said, about the problem of the Civil War in American collective memory. But I'm going to begin by reflecting with you a bit on just what we mean by collective memory, what the problem of memory is in relation to history. In an essay he wrote in 1986, Primo Levi, the Auschwitz survivor poet, in an essay called The Memory of Offense, he said this. He said, the end point, I quote him, of the deformation of the memory of a committed fault is its complete suppression. Such suppressions of memory and responsibility for them can be the result, said Levy, quote, of a deliberate intent to lie. But in most cases, we are faced with a fossilized lie, an ancient lie, frozen into formula. I have always found that metaphor appropriate for what happened to the memory of our most divisive event, the Civil War in America. It did become, with time, frozen into formulas, and to a certain extent, a fossilized lie. Almost nothing renders us human as much as our unique capacity for memory. Other animals surely have memory in biological or even social forms. They can do amazing things in flocks or in herds. But no other creatures, so far as we know, can use memory to create, to record experience, to forge self-conscious associations, to form and practice language, to know, collect, narrate, and write their own pasts. We not only can know at least some of our past, we know that we know it. As the Israeli philosopher Avishai Marjalit has written in his recent book, a little book, wonderful little book called The Ethics of Memory, memory, he says, is knowledge from the past. It is not necessarily knowledge about the past. In everyday life and in the world of scholarship, all considerations of memory seem perpetually to ride on a kind of teeter-totter of trust and distrust, up and down, with distrust carrying the most weight and trust struggling to keep the teeter-totter moving at all. We tend not to trust memory, but we use it all the time. But memory's power is everywhere, and its testimonies are ancient. In the Confessions, St. Augustine, in that long reflection on the nature of memory, refers to memory as what he called the vast court, the treasury in our minds. He stands in awe of its force. He calls it a great chamber. And no one had, said Augustine, sounded the bottom thereof. Great is the power of memory, Augustine writes. A fearful thing, oh my God, a deep and boundless manifoldness, and this thing is the mind, and this am I myself. Augustine seemed convinced that we are our memories. They dictate to us, we respond to them, and we endlessly revise them. Memory can control us, it can overwhelm us, it can even poison us. Or it can save us sometimes from confusion and despair. As individuals, we cannot live effectively without it. But it is also part of the agony of the human condition to live with it as well. We have no choice. Is all of this equally true when memory takes on the collective, social, group form as it is for individuals? How do we know a collective memory when we meet one? Do whole societies take their very sustenance from memory in similar ways as do individuals? Svetlana Boym, a scholar of nostalgia in a recent book, aptly calls collective memory a, quote, messy, unsystematic concept. And it is. We do indeed need to be careful with terms like popular, public, collective memory. We need to tie them to historical particulars and to specific contexts. But the idea of collective memory is, I think, indispensable to understanding how people comprehend themselves in time. We should worry about memory collectively, as Augustine worried about it personally. He was so worried because God knew his memory. Contending social memories explode in our faces every day in the world, as we all know. And historians ignore the social power of memory at their peril. Pierre Nora defined collective memory as what he called what remains of the past in the lived reality of groups, or what these groups make of the past. This process of making collective memories goes on every day in all societies, especially about our most traumatic events. It is that making of collective memory through all its many mediums that is our subject. Why and how it happens and who controls it and who gets to make it and why some others don't. Scholars especially do not ordinarily trust memory, whether it's in the form of oral histories or whether it's in other mediums and forms. But we have been captured by its charms in the recent decade or two, by its significance and its role in helping us explain how history is used and understood, how versions of the past endlessly contend with one another for control over the sovereign present, and how the study of memory is also the study of forgetting. Willful, organized, or sometimes unconscious forgetting. In his novel called The Hamlet, William Faulkner, the great Southern writer, reminds us of our human weakness when it comes to embarrassing or traumatic memory. And this line comes in a Southern dialect. One of his characters says, "Only thank God men have done learned how to forget quick what they ain't brave enough to try to cure." What a nice, succinct characterization of Civil War memory in America that passage makes. And then there is Mark Twain, warning us simply not to depend on memory at all as a human faculty, as only Twain would. "When I was a young man," said Twain, "I remembered everything, whether it happened or not. But now that I'm an old man, I remember only the things that never happened." But even though we know the world is riven with too much memory, too much war, too much nationalism, too much exploitation enacted in the name of someone's memory or some version of the past, in the balance sheet of remembrance versus forgetting, it is far more dangerous, usually, to forget. In Gabriel Garcia Marquez's epic novel called 100 Years of Solitude, and many of you may know this work, a plague attacks a small village, causing the people to lose parts of their memory in stages. Now, magic happens in Garcia Marquez's fiction, so I warn you. First, each person in the village loses the ability to recollect their childhood. Then names and functions of all manner of objects begin to vanish slowly. Then identities begin to vanish, and people do not recognize one another. And some even lose a sense of their own being. There's a silversmith in the story named Buendia, and he becomes terrified that he cannot remember the word anvil for one of his own crucial tools for his profession. And he begins to frantically place labels on everything in his house in the hope that he will not lose all of his memory. He starts labeling everything. He labels animals and plants and furniture and windows, a cow and a pig and a banana and every object in his house. and little by little, writes Garcia Marquez, studying the infinite possibilities of the loss of memory, he, Buendia, realized that the day might come when things would be recognized by their inscriptions, but no one would remember their use or their function. So he begins to write longer and longer and longer descriptions of the functions of every object in his life. Buendia is going crazy. He becomes traumatized by the prospect of living a life of endless labeling to survive with a sense of his humanity. He tries to develop a memory machine that will store the written entries of all experiences and all knowledge in each villager's life. I warned you about the magic. And after placing thousands of entries into his machine, Buendia is mercifully saved from his nightmare, somehow, by a friend who cures him miraculously, if slowly, from the plague. Buendia recovers his full power of memory slowly. But he had been to the precipice. He had seen this world without memory, a world of despair and incurable confusion, a world where people lost their humanity in an anarchy of ignorance. Personal identity had died, and all forms of symbolic communication, language even, had ceased. Memory, that story implies, is at the heart of our humanity. Is our own struggle in America to face our past relationships to questions like slavery, the Civil War, the slave trade, the Reconstruction era, and that list could go on. Are we a little like Garcia Marquez's silversmith? We label. And we want to make sure we label it before the next group labels it. And we want that inscription to be our inscription and not their inscription on the memorial or the monument or in the textbook. Memory can be a safe place to escape to. Or perhaps it sometimes just plays romantic, sentimental tricks on us. The concepts of history and memory can be conflated. Sometimes we just use the terms synonymously. But I have found that the more and more I write about, think about, and lecture about history and memory, I have found that keeping something separate and distinct in the uses and in the uses of history and memory is valuable. History is what trained historians do. It's a reasoned reconstruction of the past rooted in research. It tends to be critical and skeptical of human motive and action, and it's therefore more secular than what people commonly call memory. History can be read by or belong to everyone, at least in an open society. It is more relative, therefore, and it's contingent on place and chronology and scale and a host of other factors. But if history is shared and secular, memory is often treated as a sacred set of absolute meanings and stories, possessed as the heritage or the identity of a community. Memory is often owned. History just gets interpreted. Memory is passed down through generations. History just gets revised. Memory often coalesces in objects and sites and monuments and places. History seeks to understand contexts in all their complexity, and that's why it's harder. History asserts the authority of academic training, of canons of evidence, of authority. Memory carries, though, the often more immediate authority of community membership and some kind of personal experience. In an essay about the slave trade and the problem of memory, the American historian Bernard Bailyn aptly stated memory's appeal. Its appeal, he said, is in its relation to the past as an embrace, ultimately emotional and not intellectual. In short, historians these days study memory because it has been such an important modern instrument of power. And what we have come to understand is simply that the process by which societies or nations remember collectively itself has a history. And we're writing histories of memory. Now, to our problem with the Civil War in our memory in America. I was at the Huntington Library about a year and a half ago doing 2 days of that's in California, doing 2 days of research before I was to give a lecture, and I decided to simply rustle around in the papers of Alan Nevins, who was an important and very important American historian of the 1950s and 60s. Nevins led, among others, the American Civil War Centennial Commission in the early 1960s. And buried in his papers, I found an essay by one of my heroes that I had never read. It was by Bruce Catton. I don't know how many of you grew up reading Bruce Catton. If you are Civil War enthusiasts, I suspect you have. He was the most popular writer about the American Civil War in the 1950s and 60s. He wrote 7 or 8 books, narrative histories of the Civil War, mostly military history. And as a teenager, I grew up on his books, books like A Stillness at Appomattox, Mr. Lincoln's Army, Glory Road, Terrible Swift Sword. He took most of his titles out of the Battle Hymn of the Republic. But as a kid, I loved his prose. It was just this magical narrative prose, like Macaulay. I mean, it just drew you in. You had to read the next paragraph when you read Bruce Catton. And he's still one of my heroes. I actually still teach one of his books every chance when I get a chance. But here was this essay, When My Hero Let Me Down. It was an essay entitled The End of the Centennial, which was the centennial of the Civil War, and was written in 1965. And Catton, like Nevins, had been a major player in the U.S. Civil War Centennial Commission. In this particular little essay, Catton used the term memory quite forthrightly, which I was happy to see, because here I was publishing a book on Civil War memory, and I'm always looking for someone who's using the same terminology I am. Catton marveled at how Americans had, in his words, healed from their Civil War, and that a nation could actually commemorate, as they were back then, a Civil War so openly at all. He found that remarkable. Civil wars are not easily remembered. The war was a source, said Catton, and here, hence, the title of this lecture. The war was a source, he said, of unity. The memory of our Civil War, I'm quoting him, has not been a divisive force in this country. I'll repeat that. The memory of our Civil War has not been a divisive force in this country. This is 1965, Bruce Catton. I had just published a book that argued exactly the opposite for nearly 500 pages. And here's one of my heroes saying, there was no source of divisiveness. No divisiveness. For forging all of this unity, Catton gave much of the credit to Ulysses Grant and Robert E. Lee at Appomattox and the nature of the surrender that they signed that ended the war, the compassion of the surrender. How wars end often have a good deal to do with how they get remembered, at least immediately. But primarily, Bruce Catton gave credit to what he called the Confederate legend, or the lost cause tradition, which he described as, and I quote him, a mighty omnipresent force in the land. In all seriousness, declared Catton, the legend of the lost cause has been an asset to the entire country. And I had a chapter, I have a chapter in my book that argues exactly the opposite on that count. And I keep reading this essay and I keep saying to myself, oh, Bruce, don't do it. His portrayal of the lost cause in this particular essay was that of a benign, innocent, romantic cluster of legends driven by the assumption, as he put it in his words, that no hint of enmity should ever be kept alive from the war experience. His lost cause was a story of noble sacrifice and heroism on the part of the South in a noble losing cause, of a nostalgia for an older civilization as a bulwark perhaps against modernism, that in the end, as he put it, Catton's words, saved us. The Confederate legend saved us. Now, Catton does at the end of this little essay acknowledge that in 1965, note the date, the war had left what he called the unfinished business of Negro equality as one of its deepest legacies, and that, quote, the Negro was what the war was about somehow. But that's fascinating somehow, isn't it? It may have been actually drawing off Lincoln's famous use of somehow in his first inaugural. All knew, no, second inaugural, excuse me. All knew, somehow, said Lincoln, that this war was about slavery. Somehow. American historians and scholars have been trying to explain that somehow for a century and more ever since. In 30 seconds, I'll leave my friend Bruce Catton. But the more I thought about Catton's essay, the more I let him off the hook, and I could still preserve my hero. Because in 1965, the general mainstream understanding of the Confederate legend, the lost cause tradition, this idea that the South had fought for noble aims, for their own conceptions of liberty, for their independence, for their sense of sovereignty, and that they had died and bled on battlefields by the thousands for a cause that may have even been somehow a bit misguided, but noble nonetheless, was actually the mainstream conception of the lost cause in American culture circa 1965. And that sense that Civil War memory had unified us by bringing the lost cause into the mainstream, by bringing Southern memory to the center of how Americans interpreted this war, was accurate circa 1965. So I let him off the hook. Somewhere in their bones, wrote the great Southern poet Robert Penn Warren, who spent the second half of his life in New Haven, Connecticut, but somewhere in their bones, wrote Penn Warren, Americans have a storehouse of lessons drawn from the Civil War. Exactly what those lessons should be and who gets to determine them has been perhaps the most contested question in American historical memory. Perhaps at least since 1863, when Robert E. Lee retreated back into Virginia after the Gettysburg campaign, Abraham Lincoln went to Gettysburg to try to explain the war, and Frederick Douglass took a speech out on the road, which he gave dozens of times, called The Mission of the War, in which Frederick Douglass, the great black leader, declared national regeneration to be the sacred significance of that war. Among all the possible lessons, wrote Penn Warren, is the realization, in his words, that slavery looms up mountainously in the story and should never be talked away. But Warren acknowledged another lesson of equal importance for Americans of all persuasions. When one is happy in forgetfulness, said Penn Warren, facts just sometimes get forgotten. Or as William Dean Howells put it in 1900, what the American public always likes is a tragedy, as long as it has a happy ending. In this work I did on Civil War memory, I did what many of us historians do. I divided all of the possible forms of Civil War memory into three types. It's easier to get our heads around. And those three types are, first, a reconciliationist memory, which took root in the process of dealing with the dead from so many battlefields, in prisons, and hospitals, on a scale most Americans had never imagined. And then developed in many ways earlier than the embittered history of our Reconstruction years has allowed us to believe. The second form of memory I call white supremacist memory, which took many forms early after the war, including terror and violence by the Ku Klux Klan and its many imitators, and then locked arms with reconciliationists of many kinds and eventually delivered the country a racially segregated memory of the Civil War on Southern terms by the turn of the 20th century. And the third kind of memory I call emancipationist memory, which is embodied in African Americans' complex remembrance of their own freedom and their own experience in slavery. It's also embodied in the politics of radical Reconstruction and in conceptions of the Civil War as the reinvention of a second American republic and the liberation of blacks to citizenship and the possibilities of constitutional equality. In the end, there is no end to this process, but if you stop where I did at the 50-year anniversary of the war, this was a story of how the forces of reconciliation in our culture overwhelmed the emancipationist vision, how the inexorable drive for reunion both used and trumped race. But the story does not merely dead end in the bleakness of our age of segregation, the Jim Crow era. So much of the emancipationist memory persisted in American culture during the early 20th century and beyond, upheld by blacks and a fledgling neo-abolitionist tradition, that it never died a permanent death on all the landscapes of Civil War memory. That persistence made the revival of the emancipationist memory of that war and the transformation of American society possible in the last third of the 20th century due to the Civil Rights Revolution. Americans faced an overwhelming task after our Civil War and after emancipation. How to understand, and how many other societies face the same thing even today, how to understand the tangled relationship between two profound ideas. One is healing, and the other is justice. On some level, both had to happen. But given the potency of racism and its power in 19th century America, these two aims never developed in historical balance. One might conclude that this imbalance between the outcomes of sectional healing, North and South, and racial justice, black and white, were simply on America's inevitable historical condition, and then just celebrate the remarkable swiftness of the American reunion. And it was swift. But theories of inevitability, whether they be irrepressible conflicts or irrepressible reconciliations, are rarely satisfying to historians. At least they're not satisfying to me. It must be said that human reconciliations are a good thing when tragically divided people can unify again around common assumptions, ideas, positive bonds of nationalism, patriotism, or whatever. That is to be cherished. But sometimes reconciliations have come at the expense of terrible costs, both intentional and unseen. The sectional reunion after so horrible a civil war in America was a political triumph by the late 19th century. But it could not have been achieved, it surely was not achieved, without the resubjugation of most of those people the war had freed from centuries of slavery. This is, I have argued, the tragedy lingering on the margins and infesting the heart, depending on who's perceiving it, of American history, from Appomattox until at least World War I and beyond. For many white Americans, especially veterans and their family members, veterans of the war, healing from the war was simply never the same proposition as doing justice to the 4 million emancipated slaves and their descendants. On the other hand, a simple justice, a fair chance to exercise basic civil rights, and secure access to some land or some kind of livelihood were all most blacks ever demanded out of Reconstruction and beyond. They sought no official apologies for slavery, by and large, then. What they did seek was protection, education, human recognition, a helping hand. The rub, of course, was that there were so many warring definitions of just what healing was supposed to mean, especially on the ground in the South, and the nation's collective memory had never been so shattered. In the wake of our Civil War, there was nothing resembling a Truth and Reconciliation Commission of any sort through which to process memories of either slavery or the experience of total war, which, of course, white Southerners had encountered and experienced more than anyone. Defeated white Southerners and black former slaves faced each other on the ground every day in the American South, seeing and knowing the awful chasm between their experiences, but unaware that any path would ever lead, at least in their lifetimes, to their reconciliation. Now, Yankee and Confederate soldiers, however, the veterans, would eventually find a smoother path to bonds of fraternalism and mutual glory. It wasn't easy, and it didn't come immediately. But veterans reunions and veterans memory did become mutual, which happens after many wars, if not all wars. As is always the case, I think, in any society trying to master the most conflicted elements in its past, healing and justice had to happen in history and through politics. Americans have had to work through the meaning of their Civil War in the only place we could, in the politics of memory. And as long as we have a politics of race in America, we are likely to have a politics of Civil War memory. In many ways, this is a story of how romance triumphed over reality in American culture, sentimental over ideological memory. For Americans broadly, the Civil War has been a defining event upon which we often have imposed unity and continuity. As a culture, we have often preferred its music and its pathos and its heroic stories to its enduring challenges. The theme of reconciled conflict we have preferred to resurgent, unresolved legacies. The greatest enthusiasts for Civil War history and memory often displace complicated consequences by endlessly focusing on the contest itself. In the half century after the war, as the sections reconciled, by and large, the races divided. Race was so deeply at the root of the war's causes and consequences, and so powerful a source of division in our social psychology, that it served as the antithesis of a culture of reconciliation. The memory of slavery, the memory of emancipation, the memory of the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution, never fit well into a developing national narrative in which the old and the new South were romanticized and welcomed back to a new nationalism, and in which devotion alone made everybody right and no one truly wrong in the remembered Civil War. There was a popular novel published in 1912, a wide-selling novel, called Cease Firing. It was written by a Southern woman writer named Mary Johnston, who was born to the upper crust, a Virginian. She grew up imbued with the Lost Cause tradition, as a young girl in Virginia would in the late 19th century. She actually wrote a trilogy of Civil War novels. Her most famous book was entitled To Have and to Hold, which was a major bestseller, and some people attribute her or claim that she was the first American woman to actually write war novels about combat. But she also grew up, it appears, with a desire or a determination to dig out the complexities of that Lost Cause tradition that she grew up in. She became quite a progressive and a suffragist, among other things, eventually. At any rate, in this novel, on the last pages of this novel, she has a telling dialogue that I think captured then, and I would still argue now, the memory most Americans want to embrace about the meaning of our Civil War. On the last page of the book, Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia is retreating west toward its final collapse and surrender at Appomattox in April 1865. And she has one Confederate soldier in dialogue with another ask the other one what he thinks it all means. What's it all about, brother? Is essentially what he asks. And the other soldier answers, quote, "I think that we were both right and both wrong," says this veteran, "and that in the beginning, each side might have been more patient and much wiser. Life and history and right and wrong and the minds of men look out of more windows than we used to think. Did you never hear of the shield that had two sides and both were made of precious metal?" Everybody was right. Nobody was wrong. In a war that killed 620,000 people and tore a society to pieces. Now, there was, of course, no lack of honor on either side in that fateful surrender at Appomattox in 1865. And I think Mary Johnston actually captured an honest soldier's sentiment that had reverberated down through veterans' memory for decades, by that point in time, this mutuality of sacrifice. But outside of this pathos and the endearing mutuality of a soldier's experience that came to dominate the national memory, another process was, of course, at work. The denigration of African American humanity and dignity, and the attempted erasure of the story of emancipation from the national narrative of what the war had even been about. That process led the great black scholar W.E.B. Du Bois to conclude in the same year, 1912, as Mary Johnston's novel, in an editorial he wrote in the Crisis magazine, he said, quote, "This country has had its appetite for facts on the Negro problem spoiled by sweets." One other little example of this, everybody was right and nobody was wrong. It's all over the culture by the 1890s, turn of the 20th century, and well into the 20th century. And actually, if you visit major Civil War sites in America today, which I suspect some of you have, you'll find this kind of interpretation, this kind of narrative, quite prominent. This comes from one of the big blue-gray reunions. This one happened to occur in 1900 in Atlanta, Georgia. As you may know, if you ever get a chance to read my book, you'll know it. Blue-gray reunions, that is, reunions of the Confederate and Union soldiers, began to happen. They tried to have a blue-gray reunion as early as 1874, and it didn't come off. That was too early. But they start happening in the 1880s, and particularly by the 1890s, cities would compete for these because they were massive conventions. And I'll end with one of the biggest in a moment. Anyway, at the 1900 blue-gray reunion in Atlanta, and they started having them in the South as well, the two leaders of the two respective veterans organizations, the United Confederate Veterans in the South and the Grand Army of the Republic, the GAR in the North, faced off in a kind of a public encounter over how Southern veterans were trying to control American textbooks. And the head of the GAR, Commander Shaw, the Northern Union Veterans Organization, chastised his fellow Confederate veterans in part this way, and he almost sounds like a New England schoolmarm. He says, quote, "Keeping alive sectional teachings as to the justice and rights of the cause of the South in the hearts of your children is all out of order. It is unwise and unjust." Well, when the head of the United Confederate Veterans got up to respond, it was none other than John B. Gordon. John B. Gordon was former Confederate general. He was the Confederate general in charge of the surrender at Appomattox. He actually surrendered the flags and the weapons at Appomattox. He then went on to be governor and senator from Georgia and one of the founders of the Ku Klux Klan in the state of Georgia, even though he lied about it in the Ku Klux Klan hearings. Anyway, Gordon got up to respond to the commander of the Union veterans, and this was his response. "When he tells me and my Southern comrades that teaching our children that the cause for which we fought and our comrades died is all wrong, I must earnestly protest. In the name of the future manhood of the South, I protest. What are we to teach them? If we cannot teach them that their fathers were right, then it follows that these Southern children must be taught that they were wrong. I never will be ready to have my children taught that I was ever wrong, or that the cause of my people was unjust and unholy. Oh, my friends, you were right, but we were right too." Everybody was right. The war must have been about nothing. It must not have been fought for any particular cause except valor. Now, I want to end with just two stories. If I may take a drink first. These are simply places to put our imagination in this complicated process of how a nation develops a collective memory of its most divisive event. In writing this particular kind of book about a subject so vast, I found that the only way to do it was to tell stories within the story. Let me begin with one story from the end of this process at the 50th anniversary in 1913, and then take you quickly backward to 1865. 1913, 50th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg, the largest, perhaps most pivotal battle in the Civil War. They staged the largest blue-gray reunion ever at Gettysburg in 1913. 53,000 veterans came to Gettysburg and lived in a tent city for 4 days. If you were a Civil War veteran living anywhere in the United States in 1913, your train fare and all your expenses were paid if you could get there. Average age of the veterans was 74. And the War Department, in the wake of it, celebrated the fact that only 11 of them died during the reunion, because that was 4 times less than the national average for that amount of time. It was considered a triumph of efficiency. At any rate, that's not the most important aspect. They raised $2.5 million to put on this reunion. It was federal money and state money. From its very inception, 5 years in the planning, it was planned as a festival of harmony, as a festival of sectional reconciliation, which is not hard to understand why, if you're bringing all these veterans. It was dubbed in the commission that created the Great Peace Jubilee. Governors of every state attended. Many of those governors were still Civil War veterans. You couldn't get elected governor of most southern states unless you were a Civil War veteran. They all spoke. There were dozens and dozens of speeches at the reunion. And it was the governor of Virginia, former Confederate veteran, William Hodges Mann, who caught the keynote of the whole event, although many others said the same thing. "We are not here to discuss the genesis of the war," said Governor Mann. "But men who have tried each other in storm and smoke of battle are here to discuss this great fight. We came here, I say, not to discuss what caused the war of 1861, but to talk over the events of the battle as man to man." There was no time or space allowed anywhere in this 4-day spectacular for discussion of causes or consequences, no talk about emancipation or any other resolved or unresolved legacies of the war. They were there simply to celebrate valor. The Peace Jubilee of 1913 at Gettysburg was a Jim Crow reunion, and I looked everywhere in the records, from Washington, D.C. to state archives, to the War College archives in Pennsylvania, to Gettysburg National Military Parks archives, to try to find a single black veteran, and there were still several thousand living who attended, and none did. The only blacks at this reunion were the workers who built the latrines, handed out blankets, and worked in all the mess tents. It was a photogenic, stunning, spectacular event, and who could have resisted it? These beautiful old men with their medals hanging all over them, they staged a feeble reenactment of part of Pickett's charge, the famous climactic charge on the third day of the Battle of Gettysburg, by some actual participants. And there were many photographs taken of the old veterans shaking hands across the stone walls, shaking hands across the bloody chasm, as it was so often called in the press. And it was covered in every American newspaper for the 3 or 4 days, and it culminated with July 4th, of course. "Thank God for Gettysburg. Hosanna," proclaimed the Louisville Courier-Journal. "God bless us, everyone, alike the blue and the gray. The world ne'er witnessed such a sight as this. Beholding, can we say, happy is the nation that hath no history." Forgetting was being celebrated. Now, on one level, that's entirely understandable, isn't it, to the veterans? At a time, though, when lynching had developed into a social ritual of its own horrifying kind, the NAACP count for that single year of 1913 was 72 lynchings in the American South. And when the American apartheid system had become fully entrenched legally, many black leaders and editors found this sectional love feast at Gettysburg to be more than they could bear. "A reunion of whom?" asked the Washington Bee, which was a black newspaper in the Capitol. "Only those who fought for the preservation of the Union and the extinction of human slavery, or also those who fought to destroy the Union and perpetuate slavery, and who are now employing every artifice," I'm still quoting, "known to deceit to propagate a national sentiment in favor of their nefarious contention that emancipation, reconstruction, and the enfranchisement of the Negro is a dismal failure." He didn't mince words. Black responses to such reunions as that one at Gettysburg in 1913 and a host of other events like it demonstrated how fundamentally at odds African-American memories were from this national reunion. In that contradiction lay an American tragedy, not yet fully told by 1913, and one utterly out of place at this particular event at Gettysburg. The final speech of that reunion was given by none other than Woodrow Wilson, recently inaugurated that spring, the first Southern-born president of the United States since the Civil War. Wilson received several invitations to give the final speech at this reunion, which he kept turning down. He wanted nothing to do, actually, with a blue-gray reunion at Gettysburg. Being Southern, having spent much of his adult life at Princeton, he didn't want to have to deal with Civil War memory at this moment in time. He kept turning it down, kept turning it down. And one day, one of his aides walks into him. It's 4 days before the reunion. Actually, it was his Secretary of the Treasury, McAdoo, and said, "Mr. President," in effect, he said, "you don't get it. You have to go. They got 50-some thousand odd of these old guys gathering there. The press, the London newspapers are covering the event," and they did. Three London newspapers had correspondents. He said, "they're covering this all over the world, so you got to show up. Can you write something? We'll get you in and out of town quickly. Today we'd call it a flying visit." And they did. They whisked him in the train, put him in the back of a convertible, drove him out to what's known as the high water mark of the Confederacy. He went into this huge tent they had built, which housed about 15,000 of the veterans on bleachers. He got up and he gave his Gettysburg Address, which is another reason why presidents don't like to speak at Gettysburg, because they always get compared. At any rate, Wilson declared it, quote, "an impertinence to discourse upon how the battle went, how it ended, or what it signifies." And then he went on in Wilsonian rhetoric, and he was a great orator, as you may know, to use a refrain. He kept saying, "what have the 50 years meant? What have the 50 years meant?" And he ends with this. He says, "they, the 50 years, have meant peace and union and vigor and the maturity and might of a great nation. How wholesome and healing the peace has been. We have found one another again as brothers and comrades, in arms, enemies no longer, generous friends rather, our battles long past, the quarrel forgotten. Except that," he went on, "we shall not forget the splendid valor, the manly devotion of the men then arrayed against one another and now grasping hands and smiling into each other's eyes. How complete the union has become and how dear to all of us, how unquestioned, how benign and majestic as state after state has been added to this, our great family of free men." The veterans applauded. Wilson folded up his notes. They put him back in the car. He spent 1 hour in town, and he was whisked off to a vacation in New Hampshire. And the Civil War had in effect become the quarrel forgotten on the statute books of Jim Crow America. A nation can have too much memory, but a nation can also forget too much. I will end with one other short story. Go back with me 50 years, reverse in time, to 1865. Spring, 1865, Charleston, South Carolina. Those of you who know about the American Civil War know that it began there at Fort Sumter. Charleston was evacuated on the 18th of February of 65. It had been for nearly a year bombarded by Union gunboats and artillery emplacements all around the great harbor of Charleston. And the lower part of Charleston, I'm sure some of you have been there, it's one of America's most beautiful cities. You can see colonial architecture as no place else in America. But much of the lower part of Charleston had been left in ruin. It had been leveled. It was a ghost town. The white population had fled, most of it. The first Union troops to enter with the 21st U.S. Colored Infantry, a black regiment. It was actually a black regiment of Union troops that accepted the formal surrender of the city. Most of the people left in the city were blacks, were former slaves, and they began to celebrate their conception of victory and their conception of the meaning of this war as they understood it. They held a variety of parades and rituals. They held one in Marion Square, named for Frances Marion, where 13 very well-dressed black women gave a flag they had spun to the Union commanding general, General Gilmore, and a fan for Mrs. Lincoln. They held a parade of about 4,000 people, many of them school children, on the 29th of March, with floats or wagons labeled symbolically. One of them was labeled, one of them had a slave auction being performed. This was street theater. And the second wagon had a coffin labeled Death of Slavery. This was ritual demonstration of the meaning of their experience. Then there was an extraordinary ceremony out on Fort Sumter, which is that island fortress way out at the mouth of Charleston Harbor, on the 14th of April, when they raised the U.S. flag for the first time since the beginning of the war, 4 years to the day, by one day, that it had been lowered in the surrender of Fort Sumter 4 years earlier. It was an extraordinary event covered by the national press. William Lloyd Garrison, the great abolitionist, was there and wept uncontrollably when he heard a black choir sing John Brown's Body. There were famous blacks and former slaves that got out there onto the island, like Denmark Vesey's son. Denmark Vesey had led a slave insurrection in Charleston in 1822. There were many others. Henry Ward Beecher, the great preacher from Brooklyn, New York, was the orator of the day. And actually, people were delighted when he lost his notes in the wind because then he couldn't speak so long. But this event, well covered, occurred on the very day that Abraham Lincoln was assassinated in Washington that night. So celebration on Fort Sumter turned into mourning. But the blacks of Charleston had been planning one more celebration, and this one was lost to memory. I emphasize that, and I want to tell the story briefly because it is a classic example of how some stories, even a story as I'm about to describe that was witnessed by thousands of people, just get lost, due in large part to the reason that some people control what gets remembered and others do not. The black folk of Charleston faced the same problem that Americans faced all over the country at this point in time, and that was how to honor the dead, how to bury the dead, how to engage in this massive logistical, psychological, spiritual challenge now of memorialization for a scale of death heretofore unimagined. And what happened on May 1st, 1865, is this. 10,000 black people gathered on what was known as the Planters Race Course. It was actually known as Washington Race Course. This was the horse racing track of the Lowcountry Planters of South Carolina. And there was no greater symbolic place than the horse track of the planter class of the Lowcountry of South Carolina. Well, it turns out that during the last months of the war, the Confederates had converted that racetrack into an open-air prison in which about 260-odd Union soldiers had died of exposure and were buried in a mass grave out behind the grandstand. The black folks of Charleston knew this. They got organized. They reinterred all of the dead in proper graves. They built a fence around the compound of the gravesite. They whitewashed the fence. They built an arch, and over the arch, they inscribed the words, "Martyrs of the Race Course." And on May 1st, they held a parade around the racetrack, beginning with 3,000 black children carrying armloads of roses and singing John Brown's Body, followed by black women. It was separated or segregated, if you like, in this manner. Then by black men. Then by representatives of the Union Army. They then, as many as would fit, went into the cemetery. Five black preachers read from Scripture. A children's choir sang America the Beautiful, will rally around the flag, the Star-Spangled Banner, and several spirituals. And then they broke up and went back into the race course and did what most Americans do on Memorial Day. They had picnics, they ran races, and they listened to speeches. That was the first Memorial Day. That's the first celebration of what my parents, later on, in the 20th century, called Decoration Day. Took its name from decorating the graves. It took on that name, I think. It was actually called Decoration Day even after the Civil War, but particularly took on that name, I think, after World War I. Black Charlestonians had given birth to this American tradition by their labor, their words, their songs, and their solemn parade with flowers and their marching feet on the old Planters Race Course. They had created for themselves and for the rest of us the Independence Day of the Second American Revolution. At least that's the way they saw it. Now, I only would conclude by saying that that oval of the old race course in Charleston is still there. It's in a park named for Wade Hampton, the Redeemer, Democrat, white supremacist governor of South Carolina during Reconstruction. It sits right next to the Citadel, which is the military academy of South Carolina, founded right after the Civil War. But no one anywhere knew this story. I had the extraordinary good luck to find it in a totally disorganized collection of veterans' materials at the Houghton Library at Harvard when I was doing research. I encountered a file labeled First Decoration Day. I opened it, and there was this narrative written on cardboard in pen by some old veteran who had copied it turned out of an article verbatim from the New York Herald Tribune. A reporter from the New York Tribune had been at this event, saw it, wrote it up in the paper for everyone to see. I got on the phone and called the archivist at the Black Archive, the Avery Research Center in Charleston, South Carolina. I said, have you people ever heard of this story? How help me out here. I want another source. One is not enough. And they said, no, we never heard of it. I said, was there any Charleston paper publishing at the time? Yes, there actually was, he said, the Charleston Courier. I said, do you have it? Yeah, it's on microfilm. Would you look it up? He calls me back an hour later and says, it's unbelievable. There it is. There's the story. And the Charleston paper had more detail. It had the five black ministers. It had the titles of the songs the children sang, et cetera, et cetera. Here I was on a story that was nowhere written up, that had just been lost. Some memories survive, some memories don't. African Americans created the first Memorial Day. All of these stories are merely prelude to future reckonings, because all memory is prelude. Thank you. I welcome your questions and comments. And
David, thank
challenges.
You very much. We are going to do a reasonably brief question-answer session. Could I just start out by asking you a question,
sure,
which really goes to memory, but slightly later on, having spent quite a few years in the American South? Mm-hmm. What you, I think, very aptly term the Civil Rights Revolution,
mm-hmm,
and particularly in terms of the South, did that at any point lead to the rediscovery of lost memories? And I'm not just thinking here, mm-hmm, among African Americans, where, mm-hmm, I think that's quite obvious, but also among white Southerners, more contested, more problematic parts of memory.
Oh, without a question. I mean, the civil rights movement wrought a revolution in scholarship, in teaching, in curriculum, in the development of historic sites. It also, of course, wrought a reaction. It brought about the revival of the Confederate battle flag as a symbol. In fact, I would argue the second most ubiquitous American symbol of all, other than the U.S. flag, is the Confederate flag. I've seen it in the darndest places, all over Europe and other places. But yes, it did. In fact, I guess I'll answer that simply with an anecdote. I was saying this, I guess it was this today at noon I was saying it. I was at the U.S. Embassy for a different reason today at noon. I have received many letters about my book, which is a great thrill. If those of you who are authors, when you find that there actually are still human beings who sit down and write real letters after they read books. I mean, I didn't think that happened anymore, but it does. And I have received a number of letters from Southerners, middle-aged or older, white Southerners, who have said, my goodness, not that I've thoroughly convinced them of anything, but that somehow what they grew up with, being imbued with this lost cause tradition, now somehow came into relief for them, and some of the consequences and costs. I received one just a week and a half ago from a man who's a lawyer in Washington, D.C., who reads history books. And he just sat down and wrote me about a two-page critique of my book, which was mostly favorable. It turns out I have the Robert E. Lee statue in Richmond facing south instead of north. I got that wrong, which I needed to know. And he grew up right next to that statue in that city, so he ought to know. But you could also say, Arnie, and I would say, that the success of the Civil Rights Revolution, not only in bringing blacks into visible power, bringing black history into our school curriculums, causing this revolution in the study of the black experience, has also, of course, brought about a reaction. And if you follow this at all in the States, this revival of a kind of neo-Confederate tradition, particularly in the 1990s, the past decade or so, it has everything to do, in many ways, with the success of the civil rights movement and the success of the teaching of black history and the incorporation of the black experience, for example, into documentary filmmaking. Documentary films on public television in America about the black experience have now become tremendous in their numbers and in their quality. And it has caused this kind of reaction because among some, it's surely a small minority, but they can be very vocal and troublesome. There are white Southerners, particularly male white Southerners, who believe they now are America's new victim, that they're being excluded from the national story, that they are now the object of disdain. In fact, they have argued this explicitly. The Sons of Confederate Veterans, which is a national organization of people who can claim bloodlines from Confederate veterans, argue this explicitly in their literature and on their websites, that they are the new American victim being closed out of the national story or the national narrative. So the answer is really that both have happened. But I would not for a moment say that there hasn't been tremendous progress, not just among white Southerners, but among white Americans generally, in understanding, for example, the sheer significance of emancipation in the Civil War. I've had colleagues in my own institutions when I taught at Amherst College. I remember going to see the movie Glory, which was about the black regiment in the Civil War, with an extremely well-educated colleague of mine in the philosophy department who is African-American, who had never known that there had been black soldiers in the Civil War. Now, he'd spent all his life reading Nietzsche, so that was probably his principal problem, and Heidegger and others.
Well,
and
that
I kept warning
too.
Him. But, there was a vast ignorance of this story that has been righted to a great extent. Some people claim we righted it too much.
Yes, please. And then Professor Cox, if you could just give him the microphone.
Hi there. My name is Colin. I'm actually from Minnesota, not far from where you grew up. And I remember when I was growing up, the way sort of we were one of the major...
Minnesota was out west to us.
Yeah. when we were being taught sort of about the Civil War when I was very young, the legacy of slavery was a very important message, abolishing of it. Was an important message, and now that I've been speaking with people about the economic history or the time period, there seems
sure.
to be a different message that's coming through, and a mm-hmm. quote actually that came up in a seminar today from Abraham Lincoln, I have to paraphrase, mm-hmm. was something along the lines of if he were faced with a choice between the Union mm. with slavery or no Union at all, he would choose the Union with slavery.
If I could save the Union by freeing the slaves, I would. If I could save the Union by not freeing the slaves, I would. I will save the Union. That was his priority.
Right. So I'd like to just you talk a lot about the legacy of race after the Civil War, and
sure.
and I'm just trying to rectify this thing.
Well, if I understand your question, is it how significant really was slavery at the heart of this war, in terms of, in a word, yes. Now, I'll point you to a book to start with. Don't you hate it when you get told to read a book as an answer? But there's a wonderful little book out, and it's very short, by Charles Dew, D-E-W, called Apostles of Disunion. It's amazing that some scholar hadn't done this work before, but it's a study of what were known as the secession commissioners. Now, these were the men sent by the lower southern states when the Lower South secedes between December of 1860 and February 1861. Seven states went out of the Union. Those seven states sent commissioners to the other slaves. There are eight slave states that have not seceded. They go to the state legislatures. They go to governors. They go to powerful groups. They send letter after letter. Charles Dew studied all of their correspondence and dozens of their speeches. To a man, they argue to their fellow Southerners that they must secede, they must move and strike for Southern independence to protect slave property, to defend a slave society, to defend their racial system. Sometimes it's in a kind of code language about property rights. But property in what? The largest single financial asset in the United States in 1860, by far, were slaves. They were worth more in just sheer dollars, in real dollars. They were worth more than all of American manufacturing, all of the railroads, the entire rest of the economy put together as a financial asset. The most recent estimate is in a book by James Houston, an economic historian, who has taken 1860 figures and translated them into 2,000 figures, but he's estimated that American slaves were worth in 1860 approximately $4.5 billion. I think he said in his book that today that would be $65 or $70 billion. Don't quote me on that. I can't remember. But about $4.5 billion, the largest single financial asset. Now, you can make that a purely economic argument if you want, but then to say that the war is only about economics, what economics? The preservation of what property and what social system and what political structure that it's based on? Give you just one other little example. Lots of our study of secession, in fact, has helped us understand this question and taken it out of the purely moral realm. I mean, I've found over the years that the problem that I think Americans have with this, and people abroad as well, is that somehow we know that most white Northerners did not go to war to free the slaves. And we know that Lincoln initiates the war, not at first, for emancipation. He's there a year later, a little over a year later, with the Preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, and we could get into that if you'd like, about why Lincoln moves against slavery when he does. But most of us are not comfortable with this idea that it was somehow about the moral issue of slavery. Well, in many ways it wasn't. Of course it wasn't. But take this as evidence. The places in the American South that were strongest in favor of secession, and we have studies now of the state of Georgia, the state of South Carolina, Mississippi, Tennessee, that the counties in the South that were strongest for secession were those with the most slaves. There's a remarkable correlation between the density of slave population and the density of slave ownership and support for secession. One of the things that the white Southern planters, the leadership of the South, feared the most by 1860 was not just this free labor system in the North, which is the way we always make the comparison. It was free labor versus slave labor. They were frightened by what they called the shrinking South. They feared that if this Republican Party gained control of the federal government long enough, and Lincoln could appoint postmaster generals and Supreme Court members, and if Republicans gained control of both houses of Congress, that the South would become a political minority interest, and what would happen? The price of slaves would begin to decline. It would particularly begin to decline in the Upper South, in places like Kentucky, where slave population was only 15-20%, even in Virginia, perhaps, in Tennessee, Maryland, in Delaware, the tiny numbers of slaves, Missouri, not great numbers of slaves. As the price of slavery would start to decline, perhaps, in those northern states in, say, within a decade, what would that mean? The slaves would then be sold. Slaveholders in the Upper South are going to get some money while they can. They're going to sell them to the Deep South. And the South is going to shrink. And the slave population is to become larger and more dense and more dangerous unless they could expand. And hence, national independence, they argued. Got to go independent. It's the only way we'll have a future. It's the only way we'll gain Western lands, or maybe the Caribbean. And you may know that there were Southerners in particular deeply interested in the annexation of Cuba for more than a decade before this. There were three major attempts to annex Cuba. In fact, it's still remarkable to me that it actually didn't happen. would have solved a lot of problems in the 20th century, as I think about it. But I know there's a beguiling character to this notion that it had to ultimately be about interest and not about the moral question. It's like, well, it was about interest. And whenever people make the last point, whenever people make the case that the Civil War is more about state sovereignty, states' rights, than it is about slavery, you simply should ask, you know, state, or you should, I think about states' rights as its significance is always in the issue to which it's employed. States' rights for what? States' rights to preserve what? To defend what? The American South, by the 1850s, had become one of only five, depending on how you want to count them, slave societies in modern history. Six if we count Russia. And it was the single greatest interest you could find in Southern society. Southern planters could not imagine living without it. And hence they risk all to save it. But after the war, they spun an elaborate theory that the war had never been about slavery. They had never fought for slavery. Slavery was only the incident. Thousands and thousands of renditions of that claim in the Lost Cause tradition. You couldn't claim anymore by 1880 that, yes, you had fought for slavery. Some do, but most don't.
Mick?
Thank you very much, David, for a wonderful lecture. Historical memory is often carried not by academics.
I'm sorry, where are you?
I'm here.
Oh, there you are. I'm sorry.
I'll wave.
There you go. Good.
Historical memory is not often carried by academics, as you know, but is often carried in popular culture through film.
Sure.
And last year, they did a poll in Britain, which I think could be generalized, saying, what was the best film ever made in history?
Oh,
and
Lord.
They asked the film buffs, and they all said Citizen Kane.
Mm.
But then they said, what's the most popular film ever made in history? And guess what? It was Gone with the Wind. And I wonder if you'd like to comment on that and whether or not you find this to be a significant fact.
It is a significant fact. And when I wrote my book, I wanted to get to the mid-30s because I wanted to do Gone with the Wind. I wanted to get to the 75th anniversary and somehow capture the significance of Gone with the Wind, both the book, which is a different entity than the film in 1937. But the project was just too big. Yes, it is significant. I mean, Gone with the Wind is, of course, the great romantic legend, the deep myth in the anthropological sense of the Old South, of a great, old, noble, ordered, organic civilization that we'd lost. Now, what is nostalgia? But nostalgia is a more complicated idea than we sometimes give it credit for. But it is a yearning for that which we have lost. But as many critics or writers on nostalgia have shown us, it's also a yearning sometimes for that which we know we have destroyed. And Americans have always been looking for a happier past in which to retreat, a place to go when the present is uncomfortable, a place to go when modernization is just overwhelming. When industrialization is overwhelming, when modernization is overwhelming, when cyberspace is overwhelming, we've always yearned for that retreat. We've never had a better retreat to make than the great legends of the Old South. Apart from film, I mean, the equivalent of films before the turn of the 20th century was, of course, popular literature. The most popular writer in the United States in 1890 to 95 was not Mark Twain, I'm sorry to report. It surely wasn't Ambrose Bierce. It was Thomas Nelson Page, the great writer of one short story after another about faithful slaves, the Happy Darkey story. There was a formulaic literature. He wrote the same story over and over of Uncle Jim or Tommy and Aunt Harriet or Mary. They always ended with the plantation in some sort of order. And they often ended literally with moonlight and magnolia trees. I'm not kidding. I mean, that's we often call it the moonlight magnolia genre. But he often ended his stories with the moon rising and an old Uncle Jimmy on his porch. Now, Page sold hundreds of thousands. I went and worked in Page's papers, which are at Duke University. every editor in the United States of every major magazine and every major publisher was courting him by 1892. They all were offering him more money to sign him to do the same bloody story over and over because it was so popular. He gave Chautauqua tours. These are speaking. He did readings in dialect. He was apparently pretty good at it. He would read these stories in black dialect. And the narrators were always the faithful slave. He would give these readings in places like Cleveland, Ohio, to audiences of 1,000 people in 1895. Now, what's going on there? It's some version of an earlier equivalent of the romance that movies would take the place of later. And I argued in my book that the voice on the most popular level of this American reunion was the faithful slave in one page story after another. And he had many imitators, by the way. Joel Chandler Harris actually was a more complicated writer of black dialect and eventually even more popular. He's the one who created the Uncle Remus stories of great fame and the Brer Rabbit stories. He's a more complicated writer, but that was the most popular form of literature. So Gone with the Wind's terribly important. I'll just add this. Gone with the Wind is ultimately not about the war as much as it's about Reconstruction. Gone with the Wind is a movie that argues Reconstruction was a terrible mistake, giving blacks civil and political rights was a horrible mistake, the country went to hell in a handbasket in Reconstruction, and that's ultimately what that movie essentially says. And as I argue repeatedly in my book, what the lost cause tradition, which that movie represents so fully, is ultimately not about loss at all. It's ultimately a victory narrative. And by the turn of the 20th century, by 1900, the great writers of the lost cause, Page doing it with dialect stories, others doing it in nonfiction, others doing it in journalism, the lost cause has become a national victory narrative, and the victory is over Reconstruction. It's not about the war anymore at all. And in that sense, the lost cause became a virulent racial ideology. Gone with the Wind represents that.
Professor Blake.
Sorry, I'll take two questions up on the balcony. Yes, you sir first, and then over there.
Do you think that the misperceptions about the aims of the North contributed as much to this distortion of Civil War memory as misperception about the aims of the South?
That's a great question, and one I have always struggled with to some extent. That is, did Northerners, in part, are you asking, were Northerners susceptible to this lost cause tradition and to the culture of reconciliation, in part because their own, I'm generalizing, but their own commitments to emancipation may never have been all that deep? I think the answer, if we generalize here, is largely yes. But there we also have to factor in a society that has been so traumatized by war, that needs reunion, that needs reconciliation, especially after an economic depression in 1873, that needs a politics of reunion because it's good for investment in the South. There are lots of reasons why the reunion is necessary ultimately. But I take the question, it's a very good question. How deep was this commitment to emancipation? Well, it's a paradoxical answer. Because on the one hand, we have the clear evidence that when given a chance to vote in the presidential election of 1864, when Lincoln is reelected in 64, an extraordinary election held in the midst of civil war, he is overwhelmingly reelected. And he gets 70, I believe it's 77% of the soldier vote. That is, they were allowed to vote at the front for the first time, at least in American history. I don't know if any nation had ever done that, actually. But 77% of the Union soldiers voted for Lincoln's reelection. Now, if you voted for Lincoln in 1864, you knew you were voting for the prosecution of the war through black freedom, to emancipation. Now, exactly what emancipation would lead to in terms of equality was a very open question yet. You knew you were voting for that, as did white Northerners across the North. Of course, his opponent was George McClellan, who was, in effect, the platform of the Democratic Party at that point was a negotiated peace and a return in great part to a status quo antebellum. which would somehow have turned around emancipation. I'm not sure how it actually could have been done, but at any rate. On the other hand, we also have the equally clear evidence that if you had held a referendum on emancipation of the slaves in the northern states, I would argue as late as fall of 1862, when Lincoln issues the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, it would never have passed. If you had put it simply to a broad referendum, a vote of the people, the war destroyed slavery. It was ended as a necessary measure of conquering the South, of defeating Southern society, of defeating the Southern armies. So it's this complex mixture of events with volition and motivation. But now, one last point I would add to this. In the wake of the war, the legacy of emancipation, as it's now being converted into political rights, 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, the first Civil Rights Act, the Acts of Radical Reconstruction, and the early 3 years of Reconstruction, are up against this deep American tradition by then of essentially political liberalism in the classical sense, that all solutions are political. You give people the vote, there's nothing else you need to give them. That's the end. As Horace Greeley, the famous editor of the New York Tribune, the most widely read newspaper in America, said, right after the 15th Amendment, which was the Voting Rights Amendment, was ratified in 1870, in a big headline, Horace Greeley says, "Let us have done with Reconstruction. It's over. We've given them the vote. There's nothing else to give them. There's nothing else. The government is no longer responsible." Well, what happened? The Ku Klux Klan ran essentially seven states in 1870. Now, they were crushed by the Grant administration. They were run out of business during Reconstruction in most states. They'll revive in the 20th century. But there was this sense that the sacrifice that had been made among white Northerners in particular was already far greater than the country ought to ask to make good on the claims of emancipation. And that's been the problem with our history ever since. Look what we're living now. Now we're living the legacies of the second Reconstruction, the 64 and 65 Civil Rights Acts, and the whole regime of laws that came out of the Civil Rights Revolution. What do governments owe their people, and what do people owe their governments? It's one of the oldest questions we've asked about America ever since we've had a constitution.
Do one final question after. Yes, sir.
Professor Blight, given what you've just said about the failures, that there would be failures in the referendum to free the slaves even toward the end of the war, and what you said before, that most white Northerners did not go to war to free the slaves.
At the outset of the war.
Doesn't that cause problems for your thesis about memory and forgetting? Because it seems to me that you don't need the 50 years of forgetting. It seems that even at the end of the war, the emancipationist memory of your three types would have already been trumped by maybe a fourth type of memory, the unionist memory, or even that probably gave birth later on to the reconciliation.
The union victory memory.
But it seems like already that discourse or the memory of emancipation abolition would have been eclipsed. And
maybe, but I think that's too early.
So the second two forms of memory, when the reconciliationists and the white supremacists got together, to me it seems more like completed the job.
Well, it did. I mean, and they are powerful forces, irresistible forces in some ways. And we have to remember, too, that African Americans, too, wanted reconciliation. In my book, I argue that Booker T. Washington was, in some ways, one of the most powerful reconciliationists of all, because he needed peace on the ground, social peace, in the South, to make good on his devotion to black education and to the uplift that he believed in so deeply, apart from political rights. But I think your 1865 marker, if we can just play the game of historians here, is too early for that. There's just too much unknown. There's too many contingencies. What if the regime of radical reconstruction had lasted another decade? I know that's historically counterfactual. But in order to make these markers, we almost have to deal in what ifs. What if What if you'd had a Republican Party that managed to continue on-the-ground enforcement in the South, which the Grant administration did for a while and then all but completely abandoned by 1876, and hence what happened in Mississippi in 75 and 76 in Louisiana. It's too early to simply say that it's all over by 1865, that it's just inevitable that the emancipationist memory would never prevail, because there are major spokesmen for that position, albeit they're an increasing minority, even who are white. Albin Tourge is the greatest example, and I make a big deal of him in my book, who was he wrote the most famous novel about Reconstruction called A Fool's Errand, and he lived 10 years in the South as a carpetbagger judge in North Carolina. And he argued to his dying day in 1904 that America was abandoning the essential reason and cause the Civil War had been fought. Now, among African Americans, and this is why I wouldn't be comfortable with your marker of 1865. As soon as blacks start commemorating emancipation, which they do early and often, and they start having major celebrations of emancipation in the 1870s, 80s, 90s, huge events. They have 2-week-long fairs where they're modeling world's fairs, and they call them emancipation exhibitions. You'd have been hard-pressed to tell them. Now, they're doing it in a segregated society, and these are essentially Jim Crow exhibitions. The one in Richmond, Virginia, by the way, in 1914, had what they called a White Folks' Day, where they invited the white people in for one day. The mayor came, the governor came, the white people came, and then they didn't come any other day, which shows us the distances in those memories. But blacks were celebrating, commemorating, practicing the meaning of that war to them all along. And in that sense, an emancipationist memory does survive. And that it survived had a lot to do with the founding of the NAACP. It had a lot to do, ultimately, with the tradition of both protest and legalism that leads ultimately to the civil rights movement. So I wouldn't use that. I think 1890 is a more viable marker, roughly 1890, as a date or a time at which this story is now in place, that this reconciliationist, if you want, white supremacist combination of memory has won the day. And there's really no turning it back, by and large, 1890 into the mid-1890s. And there are lots of reasons for that. But that's a very good question.
Memory is a very complicated matter, as we've heard here tonight. One of the things that we have tried to emphasize in setting up the Cold War Study Center is memory over time, how memories constitute countries, how they constitute states today. That in order to understand the most recent history, it's not enough just to understand what went on within that historical period or its repercussions for today, but also understand deep history, of which I think we've really heard a celebration tonight. We have two more events coming up in February dealing with memory in different forms. We have a lecture by another great American historian, Alan Brinkley, from Columbia University, on the 7th of February, called The American Century. And we have a lecture and discussion on the 14th of February, which will include many items dealing with the Cold War in the Third World, but among them the role of the United States and how that developed and in many ways created the background for many of the memories that are being used today in different forms for perpetuating American activities outside its own borders. The lecture that we heard tonight was not just a celebration of history, as I have already said. It was also, for those of us who love history, a truly inspirational lecture about how memory can be used by people who are both involved in looking at history as historians, but also by people who want to constitute their own history, who take control in ways that we sometimes do not expect. And for that inspirational lecture and for that celebration of history, we thank you very, very much, David. And thank you for coming.